Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Governor Herbert unveils his 2017 budget. Representative Rob Bishop asks President-elect Donald Trump to revoke national monument designations. A survey shows Republican voters opposing another run by Senator Orrin Hatch. And with winter approaching, the city has no plans to open additional overflow shelters for homeless people, Salt Lake City, that is. Joining me for this discussion, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Christopher Smart. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Public lands reporter Brian Maffley. Welcome, Brian.
Good morning, Roger.
Government reporter and soon-to-be columnist Robert Gerke. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Editorial writer George Pyle. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And joining us via the phone from the Capitol Tribune, Washington correspondent Thomas Burr. Tommy, welcome to you.
Hey, good morning.
Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. Call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255 or comment at sltrib.com. Tommy, let's kick things off with you today. Senator Orrin Hatch is maybe gearing up for an eighth run at the Senate, but there was a poll this week, and the results of that poll might give the senator some pause. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's a little more complicated. So essentially, the senator hasn't said whether he's going to run for an eighth term or not. He's obviously got two more years. 2018 is looming, though, and it's out there. And his people are very interested, it seems, in talking about the idea that he's really valuable in the Senate, and there's a reason that he should stay on for another 6 years. Orrin Hatch is 82 years old, by the way, so he's not really sure whether he's going to do it or not. But a group called the Senate Conservatives Fund, which is essentially a group that has pushed people like Mike Lee and Ted Cruz in the past, did a poll. The poll was a little leading, I have to say. So the first question was essentially, you know, what's your opinion of Orrin Hatch? And it was 72% of people said they had a favorable opinion, which is on par with most polls I think we've seen. But the next question was a little leading. It said, and some will say really leading, it said, you know, Senator Orrin Hatch has been in office for 40 years and promised not to run again. Do you think he should run for in 2018?
Yeah, it sounds
And exactly. 74% of people said no. He shouldn't run again. He should retire and leave gracefully, kind of thing. But again, yeah, it's how you always phrase questions. And his office obviously was very upset with the idea that that was not a fair question. And they're not wrong. It was leading, and we pointed that out in the story. But still, it does show us that, you know, there is some concern when pointed to facts that he's been there for 40 years.
Right.
This be its eighth term, that people aren't so excited.
Do we, you know, eight terms is a long time. Do we have any other maybe less controversial polling that that gives us any sense of how Utahns feel about Hatch taking that action?
Of current, no, not necessarily. But I think there have been polls in the past that have shed some concern about you know, that being a very long tenure in the upper chamber, and whether they, you know, want some kind of fresh blood going in. But then again, you know, the approval rating question was not leading at all. 72% think he's doing a good job.
Right.
So that tells you something.
And you said this is the polling group was one that supported Mike Lee and Ted Cruz. I guess kind of Tea Party fingerprints here.
Exactly. Now, I should point out that I forget the name of it actually off the top of my head real fast, but the Senate Leadership Fund, which is essentially Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader's group, is also pushing and saying, hey, if Orrin Hatch runs, we've got his back, and we'll support him going forward. But, you know, so there are different groups. The Senate Conservatives Fund is on par with, like, Freedom Works and the Tea Party movement, Mike Lee and Ted Cruz's of the world. So, you know, there is obviously a difference between the establishment and the Tea Party still, and we're seeing it bear out here.
You know, we've heard, so you mentioned fresh blood. We've heard in recent weeks about the various, senators in waiting, and not to rehash too much, but who's on that list? Who's considering either challenging Hatch or running if he doesn't run?
Well, Gerke can help me out here, but I think, you know, the idea is John Huntsman has not said no. He's still considering possibly running in 2018. The idea of Josh Romney was tossed out, but I think he's still eyeing the governorship in 2020. I think there's, you know, other people, Derek Miller, Gerke, a few others you thought about.
Boyd Matheson is the president of Sutherland Institute, and Mike Lee's former chief of staff is
reportedly interested, and so yeah, there will be somebody else running. I think the concern for Hatch is he's kind of got to keep Huntsman out of the game right now, because he's the Huntsman being the big name, the popular politician, and the one with deep pockets is the one who could really give Hatch some problems.
Well, and on that point, he's someone who in recent weeks has been added to the list of potential picks for Secretary of State in the Trump administration. Tommy, among various people that Donald Trump is considering, John Huntsman Jr., also Mitt Romney as well. And you wrote about this kind of reviving an old, longstanding rivalry between these two.
Yeah, if only there was a book about this.
Mormon Rivals, buy it at your local bookstore.
Yeah, thank you.
Great Christmas gift.
Plug.
The idea of Huntsman now as Secretary of State is just a fascinating new world. And who knows who President-elect Trump is going to choose as Secretary of State. You know, he made Romney come to Trump Tower and they did a meeting, and then he met him again at his golf course in New Jersey. You know, they had that awkward dinner we all saw that picture of. He's obviously been vetting Romney, but all of a sudden John Huntsman's name's tossed in. And what better way to embarrass Mitt Romney, essentially, than appoint the guy he really doesn't like, which is John Huntsman. But John Huntsman, as all right, has a lot of experience with that. He was the ambassador to China. He was the ambassador to Singapore. He was the deputy United States trade representative. He's been in the diplomatic world a lot of his life, so he knows this stuff a lot better. Mitt Romney's never been a diplomat. He looks like one on TV, though.
I want to quickly remind our listeners that you can join this conversation with your calls, and the number to call is 801-355-TALK. Weigh in on who should be Secretary of State. Should Hatch run for an eighth term? We'd love to hear from you again. 801-355-8255. Are Huntsman and Romney other than meeting with Trump, are they making any overtures to him to try to convince him that they're the best person for that job, or do they want that job, I guess? And then is that something that other people are doing as well?
Well, it's unclear if Huntsman, and I've tried to get hold of him to ask him about the meetings with him or phone calls. I don't know yet. But it's clear that Romney has done so. I mean, Romney's pretty much taken a bow, like, you know, went to kiss the ring kind of thing with Trump. His statement after meeting with him the other day was essentially, last week, was, look, he did something I couldn't do. He won the election. He's, you know, obviously going to make America great kind of thing, which is, you know, the best audition you could possibly do for Mr. Trump, because he wants you to, he wanted that apology from Mitt Romney, who had called him a phony and called him a fraud. But as for Huntsman, we're not sure yet what meetings are taking place. It was strange this week to see the president-elect name an ambassador to China before he names the Secretary of State. Usually, you know, you go from kind of top down, and so it was a little different choices going on.
Okay. You know, on those cabinet appointments that that Trump has made so far, how is that is out of order, and I wonder if it shows the kind of discord within Trump's own administration on the Secretary of State pick, but how is Utah's delegation in Washington responding to the cabinet picks that that Trump has made so far? Resounding applause?
So far I think they're loving him. Not to say that necessarily is going to be the public's response to this, because there have been several billionaires and millionaires put into top positions in the White House or the cabinet. But the delegation has definitely been supportive of everyone so far. I think that they're excited. One, it's not Obama. So that's pretty much a low bar right there.
You know, I want to bring in an editorial voice here. And George Pyle, editorial writer for the Salt Lake Tribune, you've been seeing these cabinet appointments. What has been, you've probably written about this through the course of your writing. What is your opinion of the cabinet picks that Trump is making?
Well, I guess we shouldn't be really surprised by any of the things that any of the people he's picked based on the up and down and all over the place campaign that he ran. But it does seem like, you know, they've picked a climate change denier to run EPA. They've picked a person whose favorite thing to do is to fire employees and replace them as robots as Secretary of Labor. I mean, now we ought to call it, even change the name of the department. The
Secretary
World
of Robots? Is that,
yeah,
that's
there
a
we go.
Cool
or
title, actually.
Secretary of sub-minimum wage or something like that.
Yeah.
One of the people from the World Wrestling Federation will now run the Small Business Administration. And again, as you said, you know, picking the ambassador to China before you've picked Secretary of State, usually you ask the Secretary of State who they think should be the ambassador to China, which is out of order. But as you know, and also as we've said, this auditioning for Secretary of State does seem in large measure from way out here to be just sort of designed to embarrass Mitt Romney, to make him come back and
grovel, maybe.
And grovel, but and well, and John Huntsman, who was not a big, he supported Trump, but he wasn't, you know, out there on the hustings. But now he said things like, "Oh, this will change everything, and this will kind of upset things, maybe in a good way." He wasn't so upset about the communication between Trump and the president of Taiwan as everybody else was. It kind of reminds me, it's like when Napoleon escaped from his exile and started marching back to Paris, the newspaper headlines, the day he escaped, it was like, "Tyrant escapes." And then the closer he got to Paris, the more positive the newspaper headlines got about how wonderful it was that Napoleon was returning home. Just, you know, as it kind of whoever's in power is the person you want to suck up to.
Well, a warning to the press there, and groveling for power, an ancient tradition, as George Pyle is pointing out.
And just one comment on Orrin Hatch. I mean, you get in, you get to be an incumbent, you get to be there forever. People start to look at you as being indispensable. And to continue with the French theme, Charles de Gaulle once said, "The graveyards are full of indispensable men." Mm-hmm. So we can do without just about anybody.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point, and I want to stick with it's an amazing point, actually, George. I want to stick with the Utah delegation. Actually, Orrin Hatch is going to lead me to Rob Bishop here, and I'm going to go to Brian Maffley, who has reported on some other overtures being made to the Trump campaign. This is Rob Bishop having a meeting with Trump's transition team, and he had a suggestion for the team, something that he wanted the president-elect to hear. What was that, Brian Maffley?
Rob Bishop would like President-elect Trump to think about undesignating some of Obama's national monument designations. He's made quite a few, at least, you know, a couple dozen, and half of those are pretty big ones out west. You know, some of them are, you know, are like on the East Coast, Harriet Tubman's home and things like that. But there's been some big ones out west, and the biggest prize of all would be the Bears Ears proposal for Utah. And of course, we're expecting some kind of announcement down there.
Assuming it gets designated, and this is one that he has in his sights. Rescinding particular national monuments, including Bears Ears, is this something that is even possible?
Sure. It's possible for Congress to do it. No one disputes that, and Congress has undesignated monuments in the past. Monuments are typically designated by presidents under executive authority under the Antiquities Act, although Congress can designate national monuments as well. And because it's done, if the way Obama does it, it's so-called unilateral, it may not necessarily have the reflect the will of the people in those communities where these monuments are designated. Clearly, a monument in Utah would be extremely controversial, although there are lots of tribal folks and local Anglo folks in San Juan County who would welcome a monument. For the most part, it seems like the people of San Juan County do not want a monument. And however, for a president to go and undo a monument that his predecessor had established, there's no precedent for that, and there's plenty of legal opinions out there that suggest that it wouldn't be legal, it wouldn't hold up in the courts.
110 years of Antiquities Act history, and that hasn't been tried yet. And Rob Bishop's asking President Trump to be the kind of guinea pig on that experiment. Did he?
Sure, but why can't Rob Bishop then try to run legislation to undo the monument himself? I mean, maybe that's I mean, Jason Chaffetz has promised to pursue such an option should a monument be designated. So I have a feeling that would be option number one, because it would be clean. It wouldn't be something you could fight in the courts. If Trump does it, the tribes, environmental groups, any number of people would challenge it. Yeah.
Okay, in a legal sense. Does the fact that we're even having this conversation represent a kind of turning point in American public lands policy, conservation policy, right now?
Yeah. Well, right now we're going from a transition of a presidential administration that's been very open to conserving big swaths of public land to a president we're presuming would not be so open to such a move, to such conservation measures. It's a big deal to set aside 100, 200, 400,000 acres.
Okay. Well, actually, George Pyle, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back in just a minute's time, I want to ask you to weigh in on this as well. And listeners, your thoughts and questions are welcome. Call us at 801-355-TALK or comment at sltrib.com. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup. I'm Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Tribune's Brian Maffley, Thomas Burr, Robert Gerke, Christopher Smart, and George Pyle. And before we left for the break, we were talking about the request by Representative Rob Bishop to the incoming Trump administration, asking him to essentially undo national monuments designations, something we're not certain is even possible for a president to do. It hasn't been tested. Congress, you said, can do it, Brian. I actually want to get George Pyle in on this, and then we'll get to some other news. George Pyle, Tribune editorial writer. I'm sure that over the years you've penned some opinion pieces about public lands policy. What's your take on this latest move by Rob Bishop?
Well, specifically, we've come out, the Tribune editorial page has come out in favor of the Bears Ears Monument proposal. We understand the idea that it would be better to go through a more legislative roundtable stakeholder kind of process. This is what Rob Bishop and Jason Chaffetz said they did with their public lands initiative. But our take on that is that doesn't respect the desire of the elected leaders of the various tribes. And it gives way too much to the extractive economy, to the fossil fuel, to the drillers, to the miners, and basically is just what the county commissioners wanted from the affected counties. And what they want is important, but it's not all that's important.
Well, actually, I'll bring Brian Maffley on this, because there's talk of some compromise there being made in the designation itself.
Yeah, so I've heard in the last couple of weeks from people on both sides of this controversy that if a monument gets designated for Bears Ears, it would look more like what's in the Public Lands Initiative. Instead of being 1.9 million acres, more like 1.4, 1.3 million acres. What would get left out would be the western third of what the tribes are proposing. Maybe we should spend a little time describing this landscape, by the way.
Sure, quickly. Yeah, do it. We have lots of stories to cover, but I'd like to hear.
Before a couple of years ago, no one really referred to this area as the Bears Ears. The Bears Ears are a pair of buttes that are kind of at the center of this larger landscape that includes some very iconic places: Cedar Mesa, Mancos Mesa, Valley of the Gods, Grand Gulch, Natural Bridges, Dark Canyon, the Bajo Mountains, Indian Creek. I mean, an embarrassment of riches they have. Right. They have their cultural and geological treasures. So what wound up in the Public Lands Initiative was this kind of recognition: wow, these are magical archaeological rich areas that ought to be protected. The way we'll do it is we'll set aside two national conservation areas, one in the north, one in the south, centered around Indian Creek in the north, which is kind of the what would have been in the Greater Canyonlands National Monument proposal had that ever went anywhere, and then to the south, the Cedar Mesa area, which has probably the most dense concentration of ancient archaeological sites in the United States, probably the world. And so what gets left out are places like Red Canyon, White Canyon to the west, and
left out. Sorry, when you say left out of the of
a conservation proposal.
Yeah. Okay.
And those are places with uranium mining. I mean, and the one thing the Bears Ears region doesn't have is a billion ton coal deposit like the Grand Staircase did. It does have a little bit of oil and gas interest. There's the uranium in the west and some potash possibilities to the north. But other than that, it's really not a big mineral attractive to the mineral industry.
Robert, just one point on this. The designation of the monument and where the monument's designated is really only the first fight in this. I mean, the management plan that they follow on with these, that BLM then would be responsible for doing, would probably take several years to actually put together, is really what's going to determine the access, the uses of these lands, where you can and can't.
And that's negotiated sort of tooth and nail.
And that'll be the Trump administration that does that.
Yeah. You know, well, speaking of this, actually, there's some breaking news related to public lands and BLM in general. There are reports that Trump hasn't named, but is leaning towards a particular Interior Secretary pick.
We just saw this in the New York Times just now. They're reporting that Kathy McMorris, a congresswoman from Washington, is likely to be named Interior Secretary.
It's interesting news, and we do have other stories to cover, so we're going to have to leave it there. But between this and what might happen at EPA, there's no shortage of environment-related stories, I'm sure, to cover in the coming years. And, of course, much to check out already at sltrib.com. Brian Maffley, we'll circle back to you to hear about a pending state for federal lands swap later in the show. But right now I want to turn to some reporting that Chris Smart did this week on Salt Lake City. And Chris, first off, there's a rebuild going on out at the Salt Lake City Airport, the international airport, and just got a fair deal more expensive. What happened and who has to foot the bill?
Well, so you've got this project. It's huge. It's, coming close to $3 billion. And the first phase was going to be about $1.8 billion. That is underway now. But what we saw last week is that the airport department needed an extra $350 million. And this was sort of sprung on everybody just recently, almost out of the blue. But the explanation was that because Utah is under a building boom, construction costs are up and labor's hard to find. So they did some math. It's a very complex rebuild with thousands of moving parts. And so they, doing all the math, they came up short. And so they went to the city council to get approval for more bonds. Now, that said, these bonds will not be retired by taxes. Okay. They will be retired by fees. Airport user fees of all kinds that we all pay when we go out there. So what it does is it pushes the first phase $2 billion.
Just a quick question. Is that a guaranteed retirement of those bonds through those fees? I mean, we're assured of that? Okay.
Yes. Okay. Yes. The taxes will not go up.
Okay.
We've been promised. But, you know, airports are their own economies, and they are big economies. And the airport budget is separate from the city budget for that reason. And so you have millions of people coming in and out, and they're paying fees on everything from baggage to seating to tickets, and it adds up quickly.
So the reason for the extra $350 million in this budget is that bids went higher than expected on the construction, essentially?
That's correct, because what's happened is that the construction environment in Utah right now is extremely hot, and there's a lot of building going on. And of course, there is this sort of, you'd think that they would build in a formula for construction to go up, building materials. But it's sort of a supply and demand, and demand has been high. So that boosts prices. So for us lay people out here, it's hard to get a handle on it. And so the city council just found out about this on the 18th of November. And so they really didn't have time to chew through it. And so the airport department and Maureen Riley, the director, came and said, you know, we got to have this money because we've got to get contracts signed by December 14th. And so the council went along with it. They have complete trust in Maureen Riley, who's been recognized as a top airport administrator. But there was a little grumbling that $350 is
million,
not
yeah.
chump. Yeah, $350 million, not chump change.
Is so the city council, has have they already signed off on the that budget amendment?
No, they have to do a public hearing, but they'll be voting on it very soon.
Okay. Just quickly, what was the impetus for the airport rebuild in the first place? Was the airport getting close to not being able to handle the number of passengers coming through, the load that it handles?
Well, it was old.
Okay.
But it was very efficient. The Salt Lake City International Airport was always rated as one of the most efficient airports, easy to get in, easy to get out. But looking to the future and noting that, you know, the number of travelers passing through there was increasing rapidly, they went ahead and this was been planning for practically a decade.
And slated to be done by 2020.
Well, that's the first phase, and okay. There'll be three phases. So, yeah, the first phase is slated to be done by 2020.
Okay. I can't – this is totally off topic, but is there any update on the what's going on with the Wing Point golf course out there at the airport?
Oh, no, actually. That is kind of out there in the ether. It was said to be perhaps going to be resurrected, but that has stalled out. And so I don't have any new news to offer you on that. It's in limbo, I would say.
Okay. Well, Chris, another story out of Salt Lake City this week. The city council urged Mayor Jackie Biskupski's office to open more overflow shelter space to make room for people sleeping on the street these below-freezing nights. But the mayor's office says that they're not going to do that. Why not?
Well, this is a sticking point between the administration and the city council. And in September, the city council asked the mayor for a winter homeless plan because everybody has noticed that there are a lot more people camping out on Salt Lake City streets now than last year. And so the council was worried that there wouldn't be enough overflow shelter space. When the weather turns cold, some of those campers come in, not all. Some women don't want to go near the shelter for fear of being assaulted. And they want to actually stay clear of that entire neighborhood because a lot of weird stuff is going on, drugs and violence. But the mayor back in September or October said, well, we'll use St. Vincent de Paul Dining Hall as an overflow shelter, and then we'll wait for this assessment being done by the county's Collective Impact Committee to determine whether we need more overflow.
What was that impact assessment? What were they trying to determine?
Okay, so the Collective Impact Initiative is undertaken by Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams, and what it seeks to do is match better resources with homeless people, find out best practices, and then measure solutions so that the money we spend is efficient, that it tracks homeless people and their progress, and it's a total do-over. But it's only in the formative stages. And so they went out and did an assessment of 550 people around, in and around the shelter downtown. What they found was 21% of that 550 were living on the streets. And so this was a number that apparently the administration had been waiting for. But when they got that number, they said, well, that doesn't change our minds. We're going to look towards, you know, other solutions, maybe just renting motel rooms if there's a greater need for overflow.
I'm just going to quickly interject and remind our listeners that we want to hear your thoughts on the stories that we're covering today. Call us at 801-355-8255. Or put your comments at sltrib.com. So just to kind of cut to the chase here, no additional overflow space being opened. right now by the city. And you're talking about, you know, maybe motel rooms being being rented, I guess, by shelter provided, by service providers, homeless service providers for people.
Yeah.
Is there a, this is sort of a hard question. You can't compel people into shelters. But is there a sense of that 21% who are living on the streets, how many want access to shelters and aren't getting it?
Well, here's what we know. Every year there are people who camp out. And in January and February, some portion of those people, when it gets really cold, want to come in. Now, this year, we've already set the record at the Road Home just, you know, before December hit. So the thinking is that with really cold temperatures, some of those campers are going to want to come in. And they won't have shelter.
Because when you say that hit the record, that's the most number of people staying in the shelter
ever.
Ever. Okay.
Yeah. And so, which is 1,409. That includes the downtown shelter and the Midvale Family Shelter, which holds 300.
Okay.
So, but we actually have less overflow space this year than we did last year, because last year the Midvale Shelter was an overflow for men. Now it's it's brand new, a family facility, and is not an overflow.
You know, you reported that longtime homeless activist Pamela Atkinson says she's never seen as many people camping out on the streets as she has this year. George Pyle, Utah has received a lot of credit on homeless services around the nation, even around the world, but dire conditions for people on the streets. I don't know. What's the answer?
Yeah, we were on The Daily Show, and in Rolling Stone as the place that had solved homelessness. And my crack is that we enjoyed solving homelessness so much that we're going to solve homelessness again. A lot of that was they said they had cut down on chronic homelessness. And to be a chronically homeless person, what was it? You had to be homeless for a whole year?
For a year, or homeless several times over 3 years.
Yeah. And so, and they did do a lot of things that picked people who could make it in an assisted housing area with a little bit of help. A lot of veterans were their target. They really, I mean, it's just bad to have people serve their country and then be homeless on the street. So they were kind of the top tier that they went after to try and help. And they had some success with that. But by definition, you know, if you haven't been homeless for a long time, or you haven't been homeless several times, then you're still homeless, and or on any one day. Plus, one of the things is if you've been in jail for a day, then that starts the clock over again on whether you're chronically homeless. So maybe the measure of chronically homeless that we supposedly reduced was never really a fair measure to begin with.
Christopher Smart, just to kind of close this out, you reported on, going back to the overflow shelter space, you reported on an online petition just this morning that was launched urging the mayor to create more overflow shelter space. What's that about? Who created it? And is it something that will be listened to? I don't know. Or how many people are responding to it?
Well, this is an online petition launched by Ashley Hoops, who's a homeless advocate. And it last night at 10 o'clock, they had over 600, but it had gained yesterday about 200 signatures. Basically, what it's asking the mayor to do is open more overflow space, because it's going to get cold and, you know, people could die out on the streets, the more vulnerable folks. And then those who are surviving this are just you know, I don't know how they get by. They huddle under a pile of blankets and just kind of don't come out. It's a pretty dire situation. It is true that there is a group that will never come in, and those folks are addicts and alcoholics. They can't use in the shelter, and so they don't want to come in. But there are others who, when it gets cold enough, they need any kind of shelter, and that's just it.
Well, an entrenched problem. Reporting on this topic by Christopher Smart, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter, who, among other things, covers Salt Lake City and the city council, can be found at sltrib.com. We need to take another quick break. But when we come back, the governor's proposed budget, the pressure being brought to bear on Utah electors who will cast the state's electoral college votes in 10 days' time, and more. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Robert Gerke, Christopher Smart, Brian Maffley, Thomas Burr, and George Pyle. Join us with your comments and questions calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, government reporter, for now anyway, I understand you're making the move to columnist, joining George Pyle over here. Can I ask when that gig starts?
That's going to be first of the year. We're going to kind of kick off 2017 with the new gig.
All right. Well, we look forward.
Watch for that.
We look forward to it. You reported this week, actually, I think it was Lee Davidson, the Salt Lake Tribune reported this week, that Governor Gary Herbert unveiled his version of the state budget. What are his target areas, or what is it that his budget is emphasizing or maybe de-emphasizing? What's he trying to do?
Well, education is always, annually a top priority because it consumes so much of the budget. We got 10,000 new students coming in this year, and we've got to pay about $70 million plus another $30 million in local funds on top of that to keep pace with that. So those students were one of the top concerns. He's looking for a 4% increase in per pupil spending, which would mean probably more money for teachers and maybe doing something about the large class sizes. So that's where I think it was a $287 million of the new money went to either public or higher education. There was a pay raise proposed in there for college and university professors and staff.
Was that the largest single item in his budget?
Yeah, I mean, and part of this is driven by where the money comes from. I mean, income taxes under Utah's constitution have to go to public and higher education, and so there's not a lot of wiggle room there. And that's the segment of the economy that's growing faster. Sales taxes has been flat. And so most of the money goes to education. We're talking about a $16.1 billion budget. And this is an annual thing. The governor always proposes it, and then the legislature does what it wants to do anyway.
Right.
So, whether or not it gets implemented this way. But it does put some pressure on the legislature, because when the governor proposes, I think last year it was a 6% increase, it puts some pressure on the legislature to because all the public says, well, the governor wants a 6% increase and you guys aren't getting there. He wants a 4% increase. Where are you guys going to do it? So it does put some pressure on them in that respect. The other thing that the governor highlighted is public safety. There's money for additional highway patrol troopers and overtime there.
He announced this at a symbolic location for that,
Utah Highway Patrol headquarters. And so this is sort of his other big priority, is getting a little bit more money there. Trooper salaries have been pretty stagnant over time. The other, and corrections officers maybe are even worse, the people who work at the prison. There's this phenomenon or this recurring theme where we train these officers to be corrections officers, and then, as soon as they're certified, they end up going to work for police departments or sheriff's departments around the state because they pay so much better. And so it's really hard to keep those corrections officers in place. It's not a very fun or glamorous job keeping people locked up in these cages. So those are probably the two top priorities for the governor. And the other thing that he did that is kind of interesting is going to sort of trigger this ongoing dialogue is he said that, the legislature over time has earmarked too much of the money. And too much of the money is, there's money that's earmarked for roads, there's money that's earmarked for water, there's money that's earmarked for all of these different purposes. And he said, it ties the hands of policymakers when you have the money that is, before it even comes into the state budget, is already going out to some other component of it. So he wants to have the discussion about that, because if they're going to keep doing that, then they're going to have to raise the sales tax, because, as I mentioned, sales tax has been flat, and that's, as I said, the income tax funds education. Right. Everything else in the state budget gets funded by sales tax, and that's been flat. And then the governor said, well, we can get $200 million potentially if we start collecting online sales tax.
Right.
But if we don't do that, and the Congress has been working on this for years and not made any progress, if we're not able to do that, there's going to have to be some sort of change to the sales tax side of the equation.
Well, we did see this week that Amazon.com will begin collecting sales tax on sales in Utah, which is an interesting development on that front.
A huge development, because, in terms of the online retailers, they are, the biggest one. And you've got Overstock that's already, because they're based in Utah, already does have to submit a remit sales tax. Right. So you're beginning to capture a piece of that.
I saw also in the Tribune this morning that clean air advocates hope the legislature keeps some portions of what the governor is proposing, because there's funding for new air quality monitors in this budget.
Yeah, the air quality monitors have sort of been an ongoing problem. A lot of them are wearing out and breaking down, and they've been trying to get some money for those for a number of years without much success. The governor proposed adding some money on that end. I think it's $1.4 million on that, and then $250,000 for researching for research. This would go to probably the University of Utah or the Utah State University to do research on air quality solutions. So there is some money for that. The other piece of it that's kind of interesting is there's this $32 million settlement that the state's receiving from Volkswagen. This stems from the lawsuit that was filed over their fudging the air quality right. or the emissions test for their diesel cars. So the state's going to get $32 million of that over 10 years. And there's that money under the terms of the settlement has to go to air quality programs. And so there's talk of, they've been trying to replace old diesel buses and things like that with cleaner buses and other programs like that that might improve Utah's air quality, which, if you look outside, we're getting to that time of year again. So,
and about $3 million a year from that settlement, that should be...
It's a significant amount of money, and it's money that is, again, they've been trying to, air quality advocates have been trying to get for a long time.
How vastly does the state does the legislature's budget generally differ from the governor's budget? Do we know? Is it massive?
They have different priorities sometimes, and there are things that the governor has proposed in the past that they haven't gone along with. As I mentioned, setting this mark, particularly on the education component of it, does put some pressure on the legislature to meet it. And not only that, the legislature has additional pressure this time because there is this ballot initiative that the business leaders are running to try to increase the sales tax by 0.7%. That is really going to, I think it's going to hold the legislature's feet to the fire on making sure education gets some funding this year.
George Pyle, the governor, came to the Salt Lake Tribune this week as well to talk to the paper's editorial board. You were in that meeting. Did the budget come up? Did he talk about his budget?
Well, that was a reason for his meeting. He always comes every year. And they used to invite us over to these really swanky rooms at the Capitol. Now they come to us. I don't know if that's a promotion or a demotion. But what was interesting about it was, there's all this talk about here's the governor's budget. It goes on a shelf. Nobody pays any attention to it because the legislature says, no, it's our turn. In this case, I think at the news conference and definitely in the editorial board meeting, it was here's the budget. Now, how about the future? And partly from questions from us and partly on his own initiative, the governor was saying, this is what we've got, but we've got to do something different in the future. One of the things he mentioned was the sales tax thing, that we lose $200 million a year. The local governments lose $100 million a year because people don't remit the sales tax on online purchases. He says that's one of the reasons that income tax keeps going up because we have this big economy, but sales taxes are flat in a growing economy. Why are sales taxes flat in a growing economy? Because so much of the purchasing is done online and we don't get the sales tax.
Well, we're supposed to report that.
We're supposed to.
Self-report.
That's the argument is...
George does. He's the only one that does.
Yeah, I don't do anything. I don't buy anything online. I buy coffee and I pay the sales tax. That's it. This will be the argument is the governor will argue and the editorial board will agree that this is a tax people already owe. And it's not a tax on the business, it's a tax on the purchaser. So if you live in Utah and you buy something, regardless of whether you buy it from down the street or Mars, you're supposed to pay sales tax. And you're dodging this now. You're supposed to pay it and you're not paying it. Now, people who are against that will describe that, one, as a tax increase. Well, you will be paying more taxes than you paid last year, but it's not a tax increase, it's a tax that you were supposed to pay that you're going to start paying. And they will also argue that it's a tax on the internet. Well, no, it isn't. It's a tax on purchases, just like you've always paid taxes on purchases. Nobody is taxing the internet. And the third thing is, as the governor pointed out, in the past when they have tried to say, you buy something online, you should pay the sales tax, and people say, oh, no, that's way too complicated. We couldn't possibly figure out how to charge the tax for Murray versus the tax for Moab versus the tax for Colorado Springs. That's been solved. You put the zip code of the purchaser in there. It pops up. You can get a 14-year-old with an iMac, and he can do it for you. And so if it does come up, if it does go back to the courts, the Supreme Court, Justice Kennedy, who rules the world, has said, look, it's different now than it used to be. We are not protecting the tender reed of internet commerce by taxing it. It's time to get this money out of it.
Okay, so some money there coming in and not part of the governor's budget, but I guess we'll Just going back to the governor's budget for a second, Robert Gerke, we'll see that and how whether or not it pairs up well with the legislature's own budget when the legislative session starts next month.
Right.
You're not going to be there, though.
I'll be spending quite a bit of time up there.
I'm accustomed to your taffy count every legislative session. That's the thing I most look forward to.
Yeah.
And also the governor was also talking about in sales and income tax, other than the online thing, there's like 47 exemptions, credits, all these kinds of things that cropped up over the years. Every one of them, when it was proposed, everybody thought, oh, that's a good idea, let's do that. But there are so many of them now that it really is taking a bite out of the state's income. He wants to review that. He wants to appoint a panel. If he wants to appoint a panel of education and business experts, he could probably go over to the Our Schools Now organization that's just launched.
This petition.
And there's your blue ribbon committee right there.
Interesting. Well, it's definitely something worth checking out. Making funding, I guess, more flexible in the budget is kind of part of his idea. We have very little time left, so I want to just circle back around to a political story. Early in the show, we talked about Donald Trump's cabinet picks and the plans for the future administration. But there's a group of people out there who are working to entirely prevent Trump from taking the oath of office at all, faithless electors or rogue electors. This is something that Lee Davidson reported on. But Robert Gerke, I understand that Utah's own electors are getting pressure to not cast their vote for Donald Trump. Explain that.
Yeah, so if whether you know it or not, you didn't actually vote for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton on Election Day. You voted for the electors who will go to, who will actually cast their votes for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. In Utah's case, obviously, Donald Trump won by substantial margins, so he gets Utah's six electoral votes. These electors, they have in the past and historically have sometimes gone against the outcome of the election. Opponents of Donald Trump are trying to put pressure on electors around the country to you know, ditch that and kind of vote their conscience. There is an elector in Texas who got a lot of attention for writing a column about why he's not going to vote for Donald Trump, even though he's supposed to. In Utah, state law requires state law requires the electors to vote for the candidate who won the popular vote in the state.
So they would be breaking state law.
There's actually a mechanism, I believe, to replace the electors, a faithless elector, with a alternate if they do cast that vote. So and despite the pressure that they're getting by the accounts of these electors, hundreds if not thousands of emails from around the country, they said it would be defying the will of the people, that they were chosen to fulfill this role, to represent the public, and the public voted for Donald Trump in Utah, and that's how they're going to vote.
In 10 days' time, Tommy Burr, just to bring you in this quickly because we're almost out of time, is this a pipe dream? Is it a real thing? What's going to happen here?
I think there are some people out there who are still cannot believe that Donald Trump won the election, and this is the last-ditch effort, but there's no chance you're flipping 38 electors to make any difference.
Okay. Tommy Burr, hold that thought. We have to turn now to our underplayed stories of the week as we are at the end of the show here. Who's ready with an underplayed story? Tommy, do you have one prepared?
Sure. I think the fact that the president-elect is going to stay as an executive producer of The Apprentice is amazing and shocking, and I don't think we've ever seen anything like that, but I guess Kellyanne Conway says Obama played golf, so, you know, why can't Trump be on a reality show producer?
I think maybe this whole thing he's been going through, auditioning Mitt Romney and John Huntsman, has kind of got him in that mold of, like, wanting to be the apprentice master again.
You're fired, yeah.
Robert Gerke, have you got an underplayed
story? You mentioned it earlier, but I think this Amazon thing is a big deal, and it's kind of tucked away in there in Dan Harry's story today, but there is some talk now of Amazon actually building a physical location here, whether it may be a shipping facility or something like that. Jonathan Johnson from Overstock mentioned that's in the offing. And that would be huge. I mean, you know, we lost the Facebook deal, but this Amazon thing would be a big deal if that comes to fruition.
Could happen. Christopher Smart, underplayed story of the week.
We had it in the back pages today that Justin Beliveau, who's the Salt Lake City director for the Redevelopment Agency, is leaving his post after 7 months. This comes as a sort of effect of the City Hall losing many department heads since Jackie Biskupski took over. So more of a brain drain. It's going to leave City Hall in a pinch.
Okay, a change at the RDA. George Pyle, underplayed story?
Well, I don't know how underplayed it was, but I just, for somebody of my age, I want to say, you know, Godspeed to John Glenn.
Yeah.
His flight was when I was 5 years old. And people who are younger than me don't remember, don't understand how huge this was. I mean, this was Lindbergh and everything all rolled into one. And he was such an American hero. He stayed that way, made a credible run for president, served in the Senate from Ohio for a long time. A slight scandal with the Keating Five, but basically remained a true American hero throughout the whole thing. Check out, go stream the right stuff. You'll see what I'm talking about.
Death of an American Hero from George Pyle there for his underplayed story. Brian Maffley, quickly, because we're running long.
Sure, yeah. See how fake news is all the rage. There was a fake oil and gas auction in Salt Lake City this week that didn't even make it into the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. It was that underplayed. But what it was drawing attention to is the BLM's quarterly oil and gas auctions are going online starting Tuesday, and the Keep It in the Ground folks are a little dismayed by that.
Okay. For my part, I'm going to go with a Tribune solar power story. Today could be the dividing line for current and future solar customers in Utah because the Public Service Commission will decide if Rocky Mountain Power's plan to change its net metering agreement can go forward. If the commission accepts that proposal, some groups, the new groups, would be under a different rate than ourselves were. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. I want to thank Christopher Smart, Brian Maffley, Robert Gerke, George Pyle, and Tommy Burr for joining us. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Jesse Ellis, Tom Williams, and Connor Rivers for helping produce the show, and also the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. A quick reminder that this evening at 7, the Salt Lake, the KCPW is hosting the public radio quiz show Says You at the Salt Lake City Public Library. Tickets still available at saysyou.net. Thanks for joining us, everybody, and have a good morning.